The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 316, How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa. A panel including Chase Peterson, Stan Christensen, and Larry Clarkson.
Okay, we'd like to begin. Who knows if this is on or not. I'm not Tony Teigen, and that's a disappointment to, should be a disappointment to all of you. She'd be a much more pleasant person to wake up to than I, but was too busy, and I'll be substituting for her. This panel is entitled How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa. Pretty open-ended topic, but one which I think is quite interesting and relevant. I recently co-authored with Warner Woodworth a book called Working Toward Zion, in which we've examined the interplay between the gospel and applications of the gospel in sort of the modern world, particularly from an economic point of view. We're donating the royalties of this book to charity, so I'm shameless in plugging it. And I think we have three interesting panelists who will discuss them all and then let them come up and have their say, and then we'll have discussion in the from you all. With what time remains. Our first presenter is Chase Peterson. He's actually had two professions. He's a Harvard-educated physician and practiced as a physician, and then went into a second career as a university administrator, having been a dean and vice president at Harvard and then president of the University of Utah. And I understand he's returned to his first profession and teaches medicine and is attempting to retire. I also understand his favorite profession is his third one, which is being the husband to his wife, Greta. Stan Christensen is also a Harvard man. He's an MBA from Harvard and works as a negotiation and conflict resolution consultant. Stan travels about the world making peace from his lovely home in Park City. I'm trying to figure out how I can develop a career like that. On a personal level, before he went to Harvard, Stan worked as a investment banker in New York City, where I knew him. And so I can assure you that he is an intelligent, handsome, good-hearted, wonderful human being. And in addition to all that, the thing I find most endearing about him is that his middle name is Fred. Our third presenter is Larry Clarkson. Larry is a design and corporate communications consultant and also is the co-founder and president of Entrada Institute, which is a nonprofit arts and education institute. So I will leave it to him to explain to us what his profession actually is. So we'll proceed in that order and then we'll have discussion.
This is a real pleasure and honor to be asked to think through some ideas and share them. My conclusion is that our goal is to live one life. That is a unity of profession, of religion, of vocation, of avocation, of rest, of contemplative time, and of energetic time. That is to say, all is part of one whole, the gospel. I'm led to that, I think, by Henry Eyring, one of my personal saints, Professor Henry Eyring, who used to say that when he discovered some new fact in chemistry, that joined the gospel. That was part of his new gospel. But if there is a dichotomy between profession and spirituality, the distinction may lie in the gap between our inclination to assign our reasoning to our profession and our imagination to our spirituality. Let me suggest, as a preliminary conclusion, that our professions need imagination, and our spirituality needs reasoning. Much of what I say will come and has been organized and kind of shaped by a powerful book that Jack Schieffer gave me recently. Jack is a wonderful member of our community, not a member of the LDS Church. He's the CEO of the regional AT&T office. His background, by the way, he used to be a grade school teacher and was working in Sears Roebuck at night to make ends meet when he got his first job at age 38 at AT&T in a very low position and has now risen to be the regional manager. The book is called The Heart Aroused, Some of you may have read it, by David White, W-H-Y-T-E. And the point of this book is that he wants to make the case for poetry in business, and does it in a very nice way. Now let me list a set of counterpoint attitudes that we would normally associate with spirituality on the one hand or our professions on the other. Imagination, reason. Faith versus what we know. Soul life versus our work life. Wonder and awe versus our medals and our scars. Serendipity versus planning. Lilies of the field who worry not as they twist and turn versus what is our percentage of home teaching. Collaboration versus direction and hierarchy. Tithing versus taxes. Meditation versus rationalization. And sleep activity versus work activity. Now, please, Dr. Lee Smith is in the audience. Last Saturday at this same hour, I heard him lecture on sleep as a medical phenomenon, and he mentioned an astounding observation. There's been a study out of Stanford performed by Professor Thurman, if I remember the name correctly, Lee, which for 85 years has followed families and just measured lots of things, what they ate, how tall they were, what they did, and so forth. And they're now down to grandchildren, if not great-grandchildren, of these families. And one of the observations they've just come across is that 85 years ago, we slept 2 hours more than we now sleep. That is astounding. And it asks the question, or takes us to the next question, of what are we doing while we sleep? And why aren't we sleeping as much now? That's not the thesis of my talk here, but I would like to argue that sleep is an activity. And there's more and more medical evidence now that we do very important work while we're asleep. And we may not be giving ourselves time enough to do that work while we're bombarded by the stimuli that keeps us awake later at night or earlier in the morning. Now let me give you a couple of examples of my own life of administrative experience. As opposed to the flush days of money in Utah, in the middle 80s, we had no money in Utah. We were late. The recession was lingering here longer than it had been other places. And Governor Bangeter, very heroically as a Republican, proposed a 5% tax increase. He said, and he and I negotiated this, that if the people, the citizens, were to accept a tax increase, the universities and education had to do something on their part to reduce budgets. And we set up a general match that if they could increase taxes 5% to get us through this low tax revenue period, the University of Utah would take the leadership in cutting its own budget 5%, but be left with that money, which then could be reallocated to continue financing parts of the university that need financing. And in fact, we cut our budget 8.5% to give ourselves a refinancing plan. Had we not done that, had the taxes not been increased to hold things where they were, and had the university not cut its own budget to refinance essential efforts within the university, we would have suffered serious wounds. A year later, Merrill Cook, who's still with us, then organized a tax rollback initiative, you remember, to roll back and eliminate those tax increases. And I particularly was advised to be invisible because I was represented a place that uses taxes and therefore should not be seen to be self-serving by fighting for taxes. That turned out to be impossible because the talk radio phenomenon of this world picked up the University of Utah as a easy target, identifying the waste here, the waste there, the waste somewhere else that wouldn't justify tax money. So I felt it was important that I take it on head on. And I guess I must have spoken at 85 Rotary Clubs and Kiwanis Clubs and Relief Societies and anyone that would let me speak on the value of those tax dollars for the future of Utah. I was pleased one day to be driving to Vernal with a grandson and end up driving a little too fast and being stopped by a highway patrolman. And as the thing was whistling, I saw my grandson's eyes just bulge with both fear and excitement that this policeman was going to come up and arrest his grandfather. This nice policeman came up, asked me what I was doing. I told him I was going to Vernal to speak about the tax initiative. He said, "Well, Dr. Peterson, We both have to be supported by those taxes, don't we? Good luck on your talk. A third thing, and you'll notice a sequence from numeric phenomenon, large public policy issues, if you will, affecting large numbers of people, down to something more personal. Third, our dance department at the University of Utah was in a building that was declared uninhabitable by the fire department and everyone else. It was hundreds of dozens of years old, decades of years old. And I finally decided to go to the legislature and simply play poker. Gentlemen, and they were mostly gentlemen and still are, we're going to close our and eliminate our dance department at the University of Utah. We have to, unless we can get a new building. You've got to help us provide part of the money for that new building. It was a bluff, in part, but we did get partial funding, and the Marriott family came through and gave us the bulk of it. And then in the university, presidents are supposed to sign off on tenure. Goes through a process, departments and divisions and reviews and universities and so forth. But the president finally signs off. And I wondered why they have the president sign off unless he's supposed to do some thinking rather than just signing. And one particular case came to mind. I was increasingly troubled, and I'm still troubled, as we all are, about the lack of rewards for good teaching and the need for good teaching universities and how poorly we support that at times. And a really great teacher in one of the humanities department came along, and the reports were glowing about this person's teaching and innovative methods and some research in teaching, but not research in some of the more esoteric parts of her field. And so she was not recommended for tenure by her department. I gave her tenure. And wrote a 3 or 4 page letter. It was the best letter I'd written at the University of Utah, I think, saying if you want the president to participate in this process, you better give him some responsibility. And it seems to me we've all agreed that we need a person like this. In fact, we need dozens, if not hundreds, of people like this at the university. The only problem is, and the department agreed we should have this person, but they didn't want her counted against their quota of people. They'd like good teachers to be in some other department and let them proceed with very fine scholars. We worked with Intermountain Healthcare, and incidentally, predictably, everyone applauded the appointment in the university. They deplored the appointment in the department. The person continued to do a fine job for a year or two, but finally found herself uncomfortable and took an appointment elsewhere, which I thought was a sad but probably predictable resolution of the problem. We worked with Intermountain Healthcare and Primary Children's Hospital to build a pediatric hospital, if you will, on the university campus. Took an enormous amount of collaboration. It couldn't be done. Everyone was suspicious that somehow each would swallow the other. We worked with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute to build a collaborative effort wherein the genetics effort was started at the University of Utah, or continued and really strengthened, and that's become a precursor to the Huntsman Cancer Institute. Now, again, talking about large public policy issues, and now moving down to being somewhat more personal. My finest hour was walking home on a Saturday afternoon from the office to the home, passing the Sigma Nu fraternity. And I'd been noticing that on Monday morning there was broken beer bottle glass on a Navy anchor at the corner of First South and that street. And one could suppose where the beer glass was coming from. And the fellows in the Sigma Nu posse were on their little balcony up there looking over the street, and they waved to me, and I waved back. And I said, "Hey, could I come up? I'd like to talk to you." And they asked me in, and I walked in through the fraternity and up the second floor and out through a bedroom, out through a window onto this balcony. And we sat there talking about a number of things. And I said, "You know, I'd like your advice on a problem we have at the university. As you know, on Monday morning we have broken glass on this Navy anchor of the Navy ROTC building, kitty corner across from this building we looked at. And people are cutting their feet, and it's causing money to sweep the glass and so forth. We've got to find out where that glass is coming from." I knew, but it didn't matter. And I said, "We're about to order a lot of infrared detection devices so we can have 24-hour surveillance and find out where this glass is coming from. It's either coming from here or from the Delta 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 sorority, which is across the street. And we don't know which. And do you have any ideas as to how we might save the money of buying this infrared detection equipment?" Bless their hearts. 3 days later, I got a notice from the president of Sigma Nu saying, "Dr. Peterson, we don't know where that glass was coming from, but you might be interested to know that we've ordered beer by the can." Finally, during the apartheid debate, on campuses where people questioned whether universities should have any involvement with investments in South Africa, a very important discussion. Students at the university put up shanties on campus to identify themselves with the shanties of the poor housing of the black ghettos of South Africa. And these shanties were plastered with slogans and signs and information to stimulate a discussion about the apartheid issue. I thought it was a very useful discussion. And these shanties were located in a very conspicuous place that people passed back and forth. But they kept staying there. After a week, month, 2 months, 3 months, they were still there. And after 5, 6, 8 months, people downtown got kind of tired of them. They thought it was kind of messy that this beautiful campus was being intentionally littered by shanties, which were designed to be ugly, to illustrate the ugliness of apartheid. And after 11 months, people really began kind of irritated, and people were saying, "They're a mess, Peterson. Take them down." My answer was, "Yes, they are messy. Ideas are untidy, and the untidiness was useful." Now, ultimately, we had to take them down because we can't give over state property to someone who just wants to build something. But they were there for a long time, and they were very untidy, and their untidiness was the whole point. Now, note this progression in examples from the law and management to the imagination. Perhaps that tracks the progression of the Old Testament to the New Testament, from law to feelings. Policy matters necessarily involve large numbers. Spiritual matters probably involve one-on-one, or one number. My own recent odyssey, or recycling, illustrates this. From medical training and practice to education, administration, and public policy, and now back to teaching and patient care. The test of effectiveness of public policy is numeric. The test of the effectiveness of teaching and patient care is singular. Presidents of Catholic universities are regularly retired, and they often cycle to third world small parishes. Cincinnatus left his plow, went to war, came back to his plow. But there's another dilemma between rational objective management modes and the imaginative spiritual mode, and that is that an engineer is not asked to be too imaginative. An engineer is asked to know exactly how much concrete has to be poured to make the bridge stand up so you can drive across it with safety. A lawyer, in preparing for a case, is asked to prepare a brief which will allow for really no surprises. Versus a doctor, who is more often guided by feedback en route. The dose of a chemotherapeutic agent is not fixed. It depends on the response of the patient yesterday to the last dose. The excretion of sodium in the kidney is simply a reflection of what was taken in yesterday, if the person is healthy. That is, some acts require a level of planning that reduces risk and uncertainty to near zero. Other acts can be initiated only if uncertainty is acceptable. That is, the last step cannot be predicted or planned until the first steps have been taken. How is this dichotomy joined, management and spirituality? We can decree all the important things we seek. General Motors and Ford knew exactly how to build cars that would sell in America in 1970. And they pursued that relentlessly, and they failed. IBM knew exactly what mainframe computers were supposed to be doing in the early 1990s, and they failed. And they're now recovering. Our professions need management, and they need soul. Our spirits need community, even organization, and they need loneliness. There's a lovely irony here. We meet under the rubric of Sunstone, a retreat from sometimes heavy and monolithic community for those who need and want an opportunity to speculate and wonder and imagine. And ironically, we need an organization to make this possible. I'll close with a quote from Albert Schweitzer, who said that we must study and reason to the limit of our ability, and then quiet the mind in prayer and await the insights for which our reason has prepared us. Thank you.
Well, unlike Chase, my career has been short and not so illustrious, and so I'm going to take a little bit different approach and talk about how I came to my career and how that relates to religion, and then try to tie in a couple of the things that I've learned since starting in the professional world. One of the nice things about being asked to do something like this is it forces you to reflect on something that's important and think about it in an exact way. And soon after, Elbert asked me to serve on his panel. I was in Israel, and it was there acting as a mediator between a group of Jews and a group of Arabs trying to resolve differences about access to the Jordan River. And as is often the case in these kind of mediations, fairly high-level, senior, sometimes always older than I am, people involved. And they're often somewhat surprised to get me. They expect someone looking like Henry Kissinger, and they get me. And it takes a while to adjust to that. And in this case, I could tell that there was a lot of skepticism, both in terms of my age, being a North American, coming into this kind of a cultural, historical dispute. And the second day, things seemed to go much better. And one of the gentlemen said to me, you know, we were really worried about you when we first met you at the airport and saw you get off the plane. You're so young. He said, but then we found out you were Mormon, and that put us all at ease. Last night when we were talking to you, we found out you were a Mormon. I was very surprised that this would have any bearing on things. And I'll try to sort of unravel in my talk why I think that in my profession, which is negotiation and mediation, actually the background of particularly our religion, religion in general, but Mormonism is not an accident in terms of a qualification. Just briefly, in terms of what I'm currently doing, I work as a mediator and a negotiation consultant. So it means a lot of different things. Sometimes it's solving labor management disputes. Sometimes it's helping companies merge or do a joint venture in a different country. Sometimes it's ethnic conflict. Sometimes it's race issues. Worked a lot in South Africa on race. Sometimes gender in corporations. So just a variety of different conflicts. And anywhere there are more than two or three people, there's definitely the possibility for conflict. In terms of my background and upbringing, I'm a sixth-generation Mormon on both sides of my family. So Mormonism, I'm sort of a DNA Mormon. I have a genetic makeup that is Mormon. My parents assumed that I would be baptized, go on a mission, be married in the temple, and I really haven't questioned those assumptions. I adopted them and have become my own. My father's a doctor, my mother's family were all bankers, and their friends were all lawyers, and I grew up assuming that you could either be a doctor or a lawyer or a banker, and it wasn't really until graduate school that I even thought about anything else. My parents, like lots of fifth-generation Mormons, lived in Salt Lake and attended the University of Utah in the 1950s, and were lucky enough to have been there at a time where Lowell Bunyan was teaching, and there's been a lot said about Dr. Bunyan in this conference. He had a big effect on my life. I was, like lots of children of fifth-generation Mormons, sent off to the Bunyan Ranch as a 15-year-old boy to learn to work and learn from Lowell. And this was a great experience. It was an ideal model for a kid. You go in the daytime and you work building fences and building barns, and the thing I liked least was clearing rocks out of potato fields. But at night, we would sit around and talk to Dr. Bunyan. He would share his philosophy with us and talk to us about life. And I don't remember very much specifically. The thing that he talks about that all young boys seem to remember is dating. This is the first time that any adult will legitimately talk to you about the opposite sex and some of the things you should and shouldn't do. So this is very intriguing at this age. And I remember he specifically said, I'll never forget this, that you should have more to offer a young woman when you get married than just biology. And at the time, I had no idea what he was talking about, and asked someone, and that made it much more interesting. But Dr. Bunyan planted lots of seeds that would later come up that were difficult to cultivate at that age, but would come back later in different forms. He talked, as everyone knows, about the importance of relationships and people, the importance of service. He talked about balance, and we knew he was balanced. We knew he had this education in Europe and that must be sort of important at the time, but that he was a rancher and a farmer and just really a regular guy with us. He talked about the need to transcend individual and organizational pressures, not be beat up by the system, and that was sort of a common theme from that point on for me, to sort of avoid being caught up in what he was referring to as the system, which, again, at the time, I had no idea what he was talking about. I went, like lots of young Latter-day Saints, on a mission and felt very fortunate to get called to the third world. I was working in Panama and in Costa Rica. And that had a big effect, as it does for lots of young men and women. It shook up a lot of my assumptions. I'd grown up in Phoenix in a very traditional, suburban, white, homogeneous atmosphere. And the mission really shook up a lot of things for me. It really made me question the connection between righteousness and prosperity. It made me question the connection between material wealth and ability to do good for others. Up until that point, I assumed that there was a direct correlation, and really came to disbelieve that and still do. I had a unique opportunity in my mission to work with the Kuna Indians. It was a tribe of Indians that lived on small islands in the Caribbean, on the Caribbean coast of Panama. It was a neat culture. We had to learn a different dialect out there. The Indians were extremely primitive, had never seen a car, that didn't have electricity, no running water. And I learned a lot from those people. And we had a very wise church leader who talked to us about observing cultural practices as opposed to questioning cultural practices, which was an important lesson to get at age 19. He encouraged us to let the people maintain their culture as opposed to being the sort of, again, North Americans parachuting and trying to change a culture. I became very excited about learning about different cultures and spent lots of time after my mission traveling. In the 5 years that followed my mission, I traveled in 30 or 40 countries and learned several languages and really made that the focus of my education. After my mission, came back to BYU and like lots of people, spent probably more time socializing at BYU than I did getting an education. But I did sort of stumble onto some really important people for me in my life. One was Bonner Ritchie, and a lot of you know Bonner. He, again, emphasized the same message that Lowell Binion had taught about institutions and individuals and the relationships. And his common message was, our job in life is to help people protect themselves from institutions. He also talked a lot about how to decide on where you should work and what you should do professionally. And his advice, and I took it, was to choose whatever city you wanted to live in and then figure out a job. He said that, most jobs right out of college wouldn't be that interesting, but you might as well pick somewhere interesting to live. So I went to New York City, and because that sounded neat, and went to work on Wall Street. And it was a great time to be on Wall Street. The mid-'80s, there was just so much going on. Jim was there. I was referred to one of the groups, I think accurately referred to as baby bankers. I was 23 and looked about 17. We would fly around the country advising people what to do with their finances. Surprisingly, sometimes they would listen. It was a very analytical job. It dealt with what people should do, not how they should do it. It didn't. We didn't work very much on relationships. The relationships were institutional. And this was really tough for me. I really remember for the first time feeling that I was part of something that I didn't necessarily want to be part of. I felt that feeling that lots of people have probably had when they're part of an institution and they can just sort of feel their character being hacked away at and becoming part of the institution. And it was very uncomfortable for me. I remember answering the phone and saying, Stan Christensen, Prudential Bache, and starting to think that my last name was Prudential Bache. And it was a little bit of a difficult period. I knew what I wanted to do, which is help people solve problems, but I had no idea what to do in terms of a job that would let me do that. And so, like a lot of confused people, I went back to school and went back to graduate school. And was in graduate school of business, I focused on this question of how people get things done as opposed to what they're necessarily doing. The analytics of finance didn't interest me very much, but the people side of the negotiations that I had did interest me. Similar to my undergraduate experience, I spent a fair amount of time socializing as well as studying. And I had a girlfriend who was a graduate student in physics. And I had had a very liberal arts undergraduate, didn't know anything about physics. And since her friends over on the other side of the river were often more interesting than the business school students, we did a lot of things and over on the other side of the river. And I would tell people that I was minoring in physics. She had me reading all these physics books. And it was a whole new world for me. It was very important. She talked about the sort of old school of physics, the Newtonian world, where things like reduction and control and force and measurement were the paradigms. to the new world of physics, which was more the Heisenberg and quantum world, where relationships, participation in things, subtlety, were more important. And that seemed to really start to make sense with what I found that I had liked in terms of the relationship side of business versus the analytic and the management side. It ties in, I think, a lot with what Chase was saying about looking at laws and legal structures versus feelings. And I was thinking of myself more as a feelings guy. I remember her joking, this is just a quick aside, we would have debates about the merits of business as an education. Lots of people on the other side of the river at Harvard didn't see business as a legitimate education. And I remember her saying that Christ would never carry a day planner, and all these business school students walking around carrying their day planners. And that sort of stuck with me. In business school, I spent time studying complexity theory, how things relate to each other in the world. And again, wanted to focus on the people side of things. I took a job out of business school, the firm that I currently work with called Conflict Management Group, which is part of the Harvard Negotiation Project. And what we do is resolve, help to resolve disputes, mediate, sometimes train, sometimes advise, sometimes facilitate. And I thought what I'd do for the next 5 or 10 minutes is talk a little bit about some of the lessons from the last 5 years of working in this world and how they relate to the Mormonism that I practice. The first thing that's important in terms of trying to mediate between two parties, particularly if they're belligerent parties and have a difficult history, such as the Jews and the Arabs, is to try to get them to find out what they have in common. Almost everyone has something in common with almost everybody else, and they assume just the opposite, that there is nothing in common, that the other side is evil. About a year ago, I was down in Ecuador mediating. There was a, some of you might remember, a border dispute between Peru and Ecuador. Any Peruvian or Ecuadorian missionaries here have a sense of how much those countries hate each other? No one been down there? Well, anyway, Peru and Ecuador hate each other. I mean, it's almost, it's pervasive. If you ask anyone in either country about the other, they just run off a stream of nasty things. In this case, we had a Peruvian general, very high-ranking Peruvian general, and an Ecuadorian politician, and they had a history of belligerency against each other, as well as the difficulty between the countries, and we were just making no progress with them. And meanwhile, you know, people were killing each other on the border. We decided, after trying lots of things and not making much progress, that we'd maybe have them go off and talk to each other and see if they had anything in common. And we instructed them to go off and spend an hour talking about things that didn't relate to the conflict, didn't relate to their countries, just in terms of them personally as men, what they had in common. And after about 45 minutes, they came back, and the Peruvian, who was a particularly difficult individual, said, you know, I've talked with this man, and I can now work with him. And we were very surprised because, the relationship was so difficult. And we said, well, you know, that's great. You know, what changed? What was it that when you talked made a difference? And he said, well, we were talking, and I found out that he has a handicapped daughter, and I have a handicapped daughter. And I know every day of his life what he has to face with that child. And I think based on that, I can sit down and talk to him. I think that in our religion, it's very easy to focus on our uniqueness as Mormons and as Latter-day Saints. That often has a distancing effect, I think, on others on the outside. I don't think we spend as a group, I know I don't, enough time focusing on what we have in common with others. I think that our religion, often, of course, being different from the way that we practice, it is about understanding other people, seeking truth, trying to learn from other people. And that's been a real lesson to me from my professional life. Another thing that's important in resolving conflicts is to help people recognize their own contribution to the conflict. Generally, when people differ, they assume it's because the other party doesn't understand and just doesn't quite get it. I was looking through some old talks, trying to see if I could borrow anything, and there wasn't much, but there was this quote from Scott Peck in The Road Less Traveled that I thought would be relevant. He says, "Most of us operate from a narrower frame of reference than that of which we are capable. Failing to transcend the influence of our particular culture, our particular set of parents, and our particular childhood experience upon our understanding. It is no wonder, then, that the world of humanity is so full of conflict. We have a situation in which human beings who must deal with each other have vastly different views as to the nature of reality, yet each one believes his or her own view to be the correct one, since it is based on the microcosm of personal experience, on their microcosm of personal experience. And to make matters worse, most of us are not even fully aware of our own worldviews, much less the uniqueness of the experience from which they are derived. This, for me, again, it ties back into the Lowell Binion and Vonna Ritchie for me of the importance of transcending, getting beyond your own individual situation, not getting caught up in systems, understanding the other party. Quick sort of side story. I was recently teaching a corporate class in negotiation and talking about this principle of the importance of understanding the other party and getting into their shoes. And a gentleman raised his hand and he said, yeah, this is great in theory, but this doesn't work in the real world. And I said, you know, help me understand. Tell me more about why it doesn't work. He said, I have a 5-year-old son and he's the most difficult person in the world to negotiate with. I lose every time. He said, I tried this concept of getting into his shoes. And I said to him, son, why don't you play the daddy for a while? I'll play the son, and we'll see how it feels to be the other person. And the son said, great, love to play the daddy. So the father, now playing the son, says, daddy, can't we please go to the movies? You've been promising me for weeks we could go to the movies. You're always traveling. Everyone else has seen this movie. You never keep your promises. Can't we please, please, please go to the movies? And the son, now playing the father, says, son, shut up and go to your room. And walked away. So I wasn't sure quite what to say. I told him I wasn't a parent and wasn't qualified to advise him in parenting, and we got back to the negotiation course. But it is important to understand other people. And again, I think in the church, often we don't do as good a job of that as we might. I think we're very good, particularly in forms like Sunstone, of finding what's wrong with people, structures, things, and we're not so good at spending time on providing solutions and coming up with answers and having productive dialogues. And I think that I certainly could benefit from spending more time doing that, and I think that as a religion, that might be true as well. Another key thing in conflict resolution is getting people past their assumptions. All of us make assumptions based on our race, our gender, our age, our values, what we care about. I was recently in Colombia working on a very difficult conflict, mediating between a couple of the different guerrilla groups and the government. And we're in a very difficult area in the north of Colombia, in the jungle, which is the guerrilla stronghold. And it's quite unsafe. I felt very responsible. I was the sort of lead mediator in a team of 8 people down there. And, I mean, just to give you a sense of the environment, I mean, we were working for the president of the country and had his helicopter, and he said to me, he said, look, you know, you're welcome to use my helicopter for transportation. It's the only safe way to get around. But whatever you do, don't fly after 5 p.m. because, you know, the guerrillas have a history of using rocket launchers after about 5. And, you know, as I look at my watch when I'm flying the helicopter about 4:30, I was sort of wondering what would be the difference between 4:30 and 5 if you're a guerrilla. Very difficult conflict, not something we were going to solve in the short term. And I was talking to a reporter and asking him what he thought about things. And he was really surprised we were there. And I said, well, you know, why are you surprised? And he said, look, the only reason I came up here from Bogota was because, you know, I heard there's going to be a massacre related to the North American mediators. And, you know, again, I didn't sleep a lot and didn't feel very good about being there a lot of the time. But this reporter I stayed in touch with throughout the process. We did a lot of interviews. And this is a guy who had written very, very scathing articles about these 3 different guerrilla groups that we were working with. And at the end of the process, he said, you know, this whole trip has really, you know, all my assumptions have been thrown into question. There's no massacre. There's nothing to write about. I can't human beings with interests, and they're hungry and they're angry, and that's really what I'm going to write about. Very hard if we question, I think all of us, our assumptions about other people, to demonize and see the bad in them if we spend time in them. And it's often just creating dialogue that's important in terms of resolving conflicts. A couple other quick points. I think that traditionally in negotiation, especially in the geopolitical sense, the focus has been on balance of power, force, measurement. And these have been pretty unhelpful metaphors in solving international political conflict. Certainly in this century, if you look at Europe, the Balkanization of Europe led to 2 world wars. After the world wars, the role of the nation state became very important. Now we've seen with the demise of the former Soviet Union, the role of the nation state is really changing, and lots of the cultural conflicts that I've been working on have come up because of the fall of the nation state. areas that I've been involved in, sub-Saharan Africa, that's certainly true. Yugoslavia, it's certainly true. Former Yugoslavia, former Soviet Union. Resolving these cultural conflicts are all about relationships. I think that in the church, we tend to focus on measurement and goals as we evaluate ourselves rather than focus on relationship. I think this ends up for all of us driving some of the behavior that we practice, which often isn't very helpful. I think that the focus on measuring church attendance, focus on the word of wisdom, while both would certainly be useful principles and worth practicing, are probably the wrong focus in terms of Christianity and probably over-focused on in our religion. I love Cheki Okazawa's metaphor of focusing on principles as opposed to practices, and I think that we as a religion could really benefit from doing more of that. I think that a final point on conflict, convincing the parties that there's a legitimate different way of seeing things, of seeing the same data. There are different perceptions that are valuable. I think in Mormonism, we as a group, certainly in my experience, being involved in various priesthood callings, there is a real need to agree, particularly in council, and come up with consensus, which is somewhat surprising based on other parts of our culture that are very authoritarian. But I've certainly felt lots of pressure in different kinds of priesthood situations to agree, and I think that we tell parties in conflicts that the definition of a good working relationship is being able to work out differences effectively, not to not have differences. And I think that we could benefit from this in our church as well, realizing that we are different and we do have differences, whether it's cultural differences, whether it's differences on the doctrine, whether it's differences in the process of how we're assuming we're going to treat each other. I love, and we don't have time to go into it, the story in Acts of Paul and Barnabas disagreeing about what to do about the missionary work. And in the end, they basically agree to disagree and don't come to harmony. I think that there's too much focus on harmony in our church, and that doesn't allow us to work through a lot of our differences, which we naturally have based on the assumptions that we make. The Mormonism that I aspire to practice is a process-focused religion as opposed to sort of the substance and the doctrine of it. If you look at even 50 years ago, our doctrine has changed tremendously. If we were so married to that, it really would have rocked our world. I think if we focus on how we treat each other and the process of religion, fewer of our assumptions will come into question and fewer of us will have crises within the church, and we'll all be able to help each other more effectively. Thank you.
Before you can begin to understand how my religious beliefs affect my profession, you might want to know what I do for a living. I am a graphic designer. Some of you may be familiar with my work. I have created corporate identity programs, advertising campaigns, product literature, and packaging for many of Utah's most successful companies. I am currently working on design projects for Evans and Sutherland, the L.C. Tanner Company, Franklin Quest, Megadyne Medical, and the Utah Travel Council. I hold undergraduate and graduate degrees in design and communications from the University of Utah and the University of Illinois, and I've had the pleasure of sharing my thoughts on design with students from across the state. During my career, I've won more than 300 design awards. My work has been published in major design journals, including Communication Arts, Print, and Graphis, as well as countless books on type and logo design. My posters and book covers have been exhibited in many of the great cities of the world, including New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, London, Paris, Tokyo, Rome, and Provo. I am past president of the Art Directors Salt Lake City and a founding member of the Salt Lake chapter of the AIGA. I've been an owner, principal partner, and president of design studios and an advertising agency with staffs ranging from one person to 20. And over my career, I have invoiced close to $100 million in design and advertising billings. Lest you become too impressed, there are several things you should keep in mind. Number one, most of that $100 million has gone to rent, overhead, employees, obsolete equipment, and the IRS. Number two, no one ever reads design books and magazines except the designers who are in them. Number three, after paying the outrageous entry fees for design competition these days, one never has money left over to frame the awards they might be lucky enough to win. Number four, almost all of the people who have seen my work haven't a clue to who I am. And five, all design projects end with a day of reckoning. In my business, you stand naked before your customers and your peers each and every day. Your solutions are judged by how they look, what they say, how they sell, where they came from, and what they cost. It is a profession for the talented, but not for the timid, nor the faint at heart. I'm reminded almost on a daily basis that my awards, statistics, billings, and educational degrees don't mean a hill of beans if I can't perform my next creative feat. Good designers are usually young, divorced, or a pain to be around. In my case, I like to think I'm none of the above, just prematurely gray. There are also, however, several other things you might want to know. Most days when I'm not doing billings or holding meetings, I'm thrilled to go to work. The only place I'd rather be is on a hike. Surprisingly, I have an incredible amount of control over my life. I can decide when, where, and how and why I want to work. If I need extra money, I hustle up a new project or design a little faster. And if I think my client is a crook and their product is worthless, I tell them to take a hike. At the end of most days, I experience an immense sense of pride and accomplishment. Tight deadlines give me an adrenaline rush, and I enjoy seeing my concept and ideas spring to life. I am humbled each day by the power of graphic communications. I have watched information enlighten and empower people and make a positive difference in their lives. I have also seen the garbage dumps of the world fill up with award-winning junk mail and disposable products we don't need. However, if I am selective in who I work for and the products and services I promote, if I am responsible in the images and messages I design and the manner in which I create them, I can have a direct positive impact on society, on myself, and my family. I can, to a large part, design my own destiny and help define yours. Every good designer, consciously or unconsciously, develops a philosophy about the creative process. Influenced in part by genes, experience, and education, a creative point of view can be a mirrored reflection of one's culture and spiritual beliefs. Spiritual maturity, like the creative process, is an ongoing activity. There is no beginning, there is no end. I'm constantly in flux, discovering, incorporating, and discarding beliefs. So conveying them this morning is no small task. Even in a church where public profession is a monthly ritual, espousing one's personal beliefs at any Mormon gathering is certainly not easy, especially if they appear to be a little over the edge. I have a slight suspicion that Sunstone panels are often more enlightening to the participants than they are to the audience. I believe most religious concepts to be universal. It's in the interpretation, the transformation of a divine ideal into a hard truth and packaged in a cultural icon or symbol that religious beliefs become exclusive rather than inclusive. All human beings are from the same divine source. Brigham Young, in his Journal of Discourses, said, "You are the flesh of my flesh and the bone of my bone. God has created of one blood all the nations and kingdoms of men. Whatever their color, customs, or religion, they have all sprung from the same origin. Blood of all is from the same element." As we grow older, however, the fuzzy lines that separate us from our friends become clearer and more defined. Sadly, we begin arguing religiously over the names, the icons, the symbols of our common single source. Yet deep down inside, we all carry the key to understanding our common divine origins. When I think back to when I first thought, the things I remember of a child are not words, but images. Words were learned, of course, but came later. Now I use them to describe what I once saw, as in the words of my artistic mentor, George O'Keefe. My first memory is of the brightness of light all around. It's not that I like all of her paintings. It's more that I like the way she looked. No, not her physical beauty, but her ability to see. This ability, I believe, is a gift we all possess at birth, to comprehend things through our senses. But over time, mere words, intellectual abstractions, and feeble descriptions reduce our eyes to lenses through which we can only identify and measure. When we were children, our vision was much more than the mechanical recording of elements and events. Looking was discovering structural patterns, realizing relationships, and comprehending concepts. Seeing then was always in the present tense. I believe this is the creative process, the spiritual eye, and perhaps the true meaning behind the all-seeing eye of the temple. It seems adult contemporary society during any era has lamented the loss of mankind's ability to discover meaning in what they see. In America, it's a four-year event that we will be celebrating this November. Divine light, however, is never extinguished. If it is not shining, it is covered by a veil of our own making, either personally or collectively. Christ saw the divine potential in all mankind, including the sinner, the whore, the wealthy, the poor. His call to believe in himself was not so much an acknowledgement plea for his divinity as a plea to acknowledge our own divine sinner. As Brother Brigham explains, no earthly argument, no earthly reason can open the minds of intelligent beings and show them heavenly things. That can only be done by the Spirit. When the Spirit inspires a man, his mind is open to behold the beauty, order, and glory of the creation of this earth and its inhabitants. When we lose our capacity to express ourselves, our ability to discover who we really are and what we are about, we begin to look to others for meanings and descriptions, our friends and our parents, the church, schools, and heaven forbid, the government. We no longer see things for ourselves, but become dependent upon others to do the looking for us. It's a much easier path to follow. No longer responsible for our own thoughts, we are in turn not responsible for our actions or the consequences thereof. Divorce, crime, the ills of society become rampant. Lehi's iron rod turns into a collective iron shackle, breeding mediocrity, rather than the golden key to an individual's divine potential. Brigham continues, "We should all live so that the Spirit could dictate and write on the heart and tell us what we should do, instead of the traditions of our parents and teachers. But to do this, we must become like little children." Many of my, quote, non-creative friends compliment me on my artistic talent, exclaiming, "I wish I could draw like that," and acting as though my fingers and wrist were endowed with some gift. I believe my artistic ability is spiritual, but the gift is in my eyes, not the hand. The talent is to draw comes first with the desire to see, and second with the patience to look. The fingers will follow. My wife is a pianist. I believe her talent is spiritual as well. The gift, however, is in her ear. If you want to see, then look. If you want to hear, then listen. I believe if we want to understand who we are and where we come from, we only need to look inward, as Stephen Covey knows, to our divine center. My daughters like to tease me. They tell me I'm not a true Mormon. I suppose it's because they see me visiting the Temple of the Sun and the Temple of the Moon in Capitol Reef National Park much more often than the man-made temples which grace the Wasatch Front. And many of my non-member friends are quite taken back when they discover I am a Mormon. Apologizing profusely over everything and anything they might have unknowingly said to offend me, then halting mid-sentence when they recall that I've never been known to mince words in anyone's presence, so why should they? Because I don't fit the mold of a typical Mormon, whatever that means, I guess they don't think I'm a true believer either. The unorthodox Mormon gets it from both ends. Perhaps by now you've come to realize that I believe the sole purpose of organized religion is to get you to the point where you don't need it anymore. A sort of heal thyself physician interpretation towards church membership. I'm not so sure I'm at that point yet, but at times I'm afraid my wife thinks I think I am. My favorite article of faith is the 12th. I interpret it as a creative call to action, an admonition, and a quest. As always, I have personalized it. I believe in being honest, true, chaste, except for a little swearing now and again, benevolent, virtuous, and doing good to all men and women. I try to follow Paul's admonition. I believe many things, hope like hell for a lot of things, have certainly endured my share of things, and hope to keep on trucking. Coming up is my favorite part, the quest. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, I will seek after these things. When I think about God, I think about the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament," and God called it heaven. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons." He made the stars also. Down south, in the heart of our pretty great state, is a lava cap sentinel created by God during the second day. Appropriately penned Boulder Mountain by our pioneer ancestors, on its eastern flank sits a cabin hidden by pinyon and juniper as old as baby Jesus. The cabin I built has second-story windows which during the day look up to Chokecherry Point, but at night frame the heavens and the stars that God made on the fourth day. I believe he made them for me, and I'd like to keep the air clean enough so my future grandchildren will be able to gaze upon the heavens as well. So the first time we read about God in the Bible, he is working on a creative project, moving colors and textures around on a very big canvas, taking shapes and forms with meanings and consequences, and arranging and rearranging them, looking at things and seeing they are good. To me, God is the creator. I can't recall exactly when I was told in church that I too could become a God. I do remember it seemed like a pretty good idea. I loved to create things and I was good at it. Art was my favorite subject. I thought, I'll make a great God. It wasn't long before I realized becoming a God or trying to act like one was not that easy. I remember the chiding I received during the 60s when I wanted to grow my hair long like Jesus in the painting above the sacrament table. 30 years later, my neck still tingles during the sacrament. Sometimes I look up hoping to see Jesus in the chapel again, but the picture is gone. I grew a beard instead and became an artist. I remember my earthly father wasn't too thrilled. He wanted to know why I didn't want to become a dentist like all the other priests. I started to mumble something about becoming a god, but I didn't want to push my luck. I practiced drawing pictures during church on the back of the programs, a practice I continue today. I took art in high school, majored in art in college, received an art scholarship, and went to graduate school where I taught art. I even wrote a thesis on art entitled The Creative Process, a Design Methodology. You can imagine what books I used for reference material. So I became the graphic designer I spoke about earlier. For 20 years now, I have worked on creative projects for the church and for business, created art for my children and art to pay the rent, moving pictures and type around on the page, taking shapes and forms with meanings and consequences, and arranging and rearranging them, looking at things and seeing they are good. I became a creator. As I grow older, however, the clear lines that separate my profession from my beliefs between creativity and spirituality have become fuzzy and less defined. I have felt what I have believed to be the spirit many times in my life. While gazing upon the alpine glow of Mount Olympus at sunset after a winter storm, or wrapped in the warm embrace of my wife while making love, while listening to a chorus of coyotes howling on the Tory wind or expressing my thoughts at a sunstone panel, while pondering ancient rock art in a hidden desert wash or cuddling my children in my arms at church, and even while lost in an artistic trance, creating a logo for a client. I suppose my beliefs don't influence my profession anymore. Through a simple twist, it's probably the other way around. My profession and my beliefs now appear to be one, or maybe art has become my religion. Sounds a little New Age, doesn't it? But the prophet Brigham was onto the same idea 150 years ago. In the mind of God, there is no such thing as dividing spiritual from temporal, or temporal from spiritual, for they are one in the Lord. 3 years ago, with the inspiration of an elderly gentleman and the help of several creative friends, I co-founded the Entrada Institute, a nonprofit arts organization. Entrada celebrates the landscape and culture of Utah's Red Rock Desert, or as my departed friend Ward Roylance referred to as the Enchanted Wilderness. It started when I wondered why church leaders never had much to say about the sanctity of the earth. I began to think I missed something in Sunday school when a friend suggested Mormons shouldn't be concerned about overpopulation, pollution, and endangered species because once the earth is trashed, Christ would return and the earth would be renewed. I thought a better idea would be for us to renew it ourselves and then invite God down for a picnic in his Garden of Eden. But I must say my hope was renewed recently when I heard President Hinckley's remarks at the dedication of the park on Ensign Peak. Things can change. The Institute has taken me away from many of my old church activities, however, but not from my beliefs. I suppose I'm rationalizing, but my East Mill Creek ward has plenty of prospective bishops, an ample Christmas party budget, and definitely more home teachers than they know what to do with. I still try and slip environmental ethics into elders' quorum lessons, but more often I'm wandering the desert on crisp Sunday mornings with my wife and children, my pagan friends, or myself. I try not to complain too much about the lack of concern my church seems to take regarding our stewardship responsibilities, or too much concern over personal revelation. But I find I'm giving a bigger portion of my time and money to environmental and arts groups than my church these days. I did ask God if it was okay, and I'd tell you what he said, but the answer is personal. Maybe my daughters are right. Maybe I'm no longer a true Mormon, but I hope they someday understand I haven't abandoned my childhood beliefs. I'm still a true believer. Like my other mentor, Obert C. Tanner, I hope my belief in God is expanding to embrace not only truth, but goodness and beauty as well. But now I want to spend the rest of my mortal life focused on this earth, this body, and this mind. Not chasing treasures to be laid up in heaven. This already is heaven, this earth. There is no life more precious than the present life which we enjoy. There is no life that is worthy any more to us than this life is, exhorted Brigham Young. To many of you, I may have treated the most spiritual matters in too terrestrial a fashion, but please have empathy. I am only a temporal man living on a finite earth. I'm trying to comprehend the spirit, but at times I get lost in the twinkling of the stars. Often while I sleep, I dream I'm hiking on what appears to be a deserted trail. The scenery is familiar and beautiful. I'm alone but not lonely. I can reach out and feel my family and friends, but they are not there with me. Many are in church, but many are out walking their own trails. I suppose to some these are merely trails of my imagination, but I do believe I am moving forward. Thank you.